I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It looks like President Obama is, quote, evolving on the issue of legalizing marijuana, according to an interview in The New Yorker. He's not alone. A recent CNN opinion research poll found that 55% believe that marijuana should be legalized, an increase from just a year ago. Coming up, I'll talk with Stacey Gruber about her research on the effects of pot smoking on the adolescent brain. We'll also check in with Bob Young, who covers marijuana as a reporter for the Seattle Times. Washington is one of two states that has legalized recreational marijuana. But first, we begin with Philadelphia City Councilman Jim Kenney, who has a bill that would make the possession of a small amount of marijuana a ticketed offense instead of a mandatory arrest. He's Democratic Councilman at Large, serving his sixth term. And Jim Kenney, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning. Is this a bill of sign of your evolution on this issue of marijuana?
No, I think it's a sign of common sense based on the fact that our district attorney, Seth Williams, rightfully 4 years ago decided to divert 4,000 or so cases a year into a diversionary education and fine-paying program as opposed to a prosecution, which unclogged our courts substantially. And as time went on and people started to evolve their opinions about marijuana possession and use, we felt that it was kind of silly to put people in handcuffs, take them to a police station, take their picture, take their fingerprints, saddle them with an arrest record, only to be diverted down about a year later through the small amounts of marijuana program instituted by Seth Williams. We will probably add 17,000 hours of police time to our streets, which represents 2,100 8-hour shifts that officers are off the street after taking into custody, you know, a 19-year-old with two joints in his pocket. And I think that's a savings of about $3 million a year. It saves 4,200 people a year, an arrest record that lasts for a year or more, trying to find a job. And being arrested is a traumatic experience that could result in danger to both the arrestee and the arrestor. If something goes wrong, the kid decides to take off and run, police have to chase. I mean, it's just a lot of things go on in an arrest that we don't need to go through, because in the end, they're going to be diverted into an education program anyway by the district attorney.
If this bill becomes law, then if someone is smoking, or let's say they have a small amount of marijuana on their possession, then how would they be treated? How would this ticketing process work?
The police department would have to figure out with the district attorney's office how that process would work. But as an example, at State College up in Pennsylvania, Penn State, there are 40,000 students up there, and some of them, sadly, will drink underage. They are issued a summons by the police officer and assigned it, you know, get by mail, assigned a time and place to go, to pay their fine, to sign up for their drinking education course, and they get through it, they expunge their record, and they go on their way.
Is this a first step in your own mind towards legalizing marijuana, at least in Philadelphia?
We can't legalize it in Philadelphia ourselves. It is state law. This state is not a very progressive state generally on most issues, social issues. So I suspect if we ever legalize it, we'll be the last two or three or four states to legalize it. So in other cities, for example, in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, or in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., Chicago, they don't arrest. They issue summary citations, and people pay a fine and get some education. And I think that's the way we should handle it. I don't know whether or not if marijuana will ever be legalized in Pennsylvania, but if you look at Colorado and Washington State, which have different social cultures, in Colorado, the first week that it was legal, the state collected $5 million in taxes. Mm.
So you see it as a revenue enhancer, a potential revenue enhancer, at least in those states?
Well, I do. You know, I'm ambivalent about, you know, the difference between marijuana and alcohol. But if, you know, next week when we watch the Super Bowl, we'll have, like, you know, a couple hundred commercials about alcohol, why we should buy it and drink it and use it. And on the other hand, you know, marijuana still has that stigma, which I believe is a stigma back probably from the 60s and 70s when we had, you know, civil unrest in the country over Vietnam War and, you know, hippies and the counterculture. And I think, you know, older people were turned off by the aroma of marijuana and the use of it. I think it still has that stigma today, as opposed to, you know, drinking a case of beer, which people don't think is a big deal, but, you know, it's just probably as dangerous, more dangerous than smoking a joint.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's a Philadelphia City Councilman, Jim Kenney. He has introduced a bill that would make the possession of a small amount of marijuana a ticketed offense instead of a mandatory arrest. We want to get your opinion on this. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. I'm curious about the response of other members of City Council when you introduce this bill.
Well, I mean, we have, I mean, people have not expressed a strong opinion one way or the other, but we have a pretty progressive group of people in council, and I think they recognize the reality of what we're trying, what I'm trying to do. And I've gotten a lot of feedback. I've gotten no negative calls or no negative emails in the last couple of days after the promulgation of this of this information about this bill. And I've actually gotten a lot of good feedback and reinforcement from ex-police officers and police officers who, you know, are forced to do this but really aren't that thrilled about having to engage in this kind of arrest. And that heartened my efforts to get this accomplished. I just don't want to see, it's hard enough in this society today for young people and others to find work and to make their way. And to saddle someone with an arrest record for a year or more until that record's expunged will really, you know, really make it difficult for people to find work and to move on in their lives.
District Attorney Seth Williams' program for small amounts of marijuana would be this fine that you obviously agree with, but also classes for people who have been picked up for small amounts of marijuana. Do you like the idea of having a class?
Well, I mean, I think it's something, there's got to be, in some ways, I think people feel there's got to be some penalty, and that penalty probably shouldn't be locked up, you know, in a jail cell at the roundhouse from Friday to Monday, but some just kind of disclosure to them as to the potential dangers and downfalls of you know, this kind of, you know, substance enhancement, whether it's alcohol or whether it's marijuana.
What about young people? And I'm thinking people under 18. Obviously, they're not supposed to drink either. But nonetheless, right. Some of the research shows that this lax view of marijuana, I'm not sure is exactly resulting in the increase of a number of high schoolers, for instance, using marijuana. But that number is up. Does that worry you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in general, our society is prone to move in those directions, whether it's alcohol or whether it's marijuana or even other more dangerous drugs. And I mean, again, the war on drugs in this country, as much money as we spent on it, as much lives as we lost as a result of it, I don't think ever actually worked. And I think what really works is education. And I think an educational component to some misdeed that a young person might do may put their mind in the right direction. You know, sometimes it doesn't work. I haven't come up with a suggestion as to the number of times a person should be issued a summary before other punitive actions are taken. But I think that it's a bit overkill, and I think it's a bit a major loss of resources for us to be taking police officers off the street for 2 or 3 hours at a time to book someone, as opposed to having them out there fighting real crime.
President Obama, in an interview in The New Yorker, talked a bit about marijuana, and he said poor minority kids are more likely to be locked up for smoking marijuana than white middle-class kids. Is that another reason for your bill?
Well, if you look at the data, 89% of the people arrested over the last year, of the 4,200 arrests, 89% were African-American. Obviously, they're being stopped more than non-African-Americans, and I think the stop-and-frisk policies of the city and other cities result the fact that young black people are stopped. They're asked to empty their pockets, and when they empty their pockets, you know, the small amount of marijuana in the baggie or in the rolled up joint results in their arrest. It results not only in their arrest, but results in their arrest record. And you know, it's hard enough for a young person to find a job these days in this economy. An arrest record will definitely not have let that happen.
As we know, President Obama smoked marijuana as a young person. Have you smoked marijuana?
Oh, sure. I mean, I went to college, and, you know, that was something that a lot of people did, you know, and that was a rite of passage in an era that is well behind me now. Many people who say they didn't probably aren't telling you the truth.
And is that one reason you think that there is this different view about marijuana, because people in positions of authority like you have smoked marijuana?
Yeah, I mean, I think that when President Clinton, you know, gave his words on the think she tried it, but he didn't inhale. It's kind of like kind of laughable. And I think when the president said, you know, did you inhale? And he said, yeah, that's the point. I think that it is an evolving situation. Again, I do think the marijuana and the aroma of marijuana represented a counterculture kind of group that was, you know, fighting the war in Vietnam in the 60s and 70s and were, you know, kind of the people that the establishment looked down upon, and that was one of the symbols of that establishment, of that group of counterculture people. And I think that's the stigma that stays with marijuana today. I mean, marijuana has not been, it's not a kind of chemically produced substance. It's been around for centuries. The American Indians and other cultures have used it. So, I mean, it's not something that was invented in a laboratory.
So what happens to your bill now?
Where does it go? It's assigned to committee. We're asking for the law and government committee because it affects so many different areas of the courts and police and prisons and other, I mean, and the justice system. It's assigned to committee. We'll get a date for a hearing. We'll have people come in and express their opinions, and see where we go. I think the overall opinion that people have been expressing is one of positive. And I've gotten no negative phone calls and no negative emails. And I can tell you, I've been involved in other issues relative to immigration, Chick-fil-A, LGBT rights, and other things that my email, you know, blew up. I did not get anything yesterday resulting in a negative response. And any responses I've gotten on Facebook or Twitter or email have been positive.
We got an email. What is considered a small amount of pot under this bill?
Under an ounce. I think it's 30 grams.
30 grams. Are you running for mayor?
I can't tell you that.
Well, I read that you are.
I can't tell you that. I have to quit.
Oh.
I have to resign. Under our crazy charter, if I were to announce that, I'd have to leave office, as opposed to anyone else who's running for office from another jurisdiction, whether it's a state office or a federal mm-hmm. office, who can keep their job, keep their paycheck and their health care, and still run for mayor and not have to resign. I think that's debilitating for city elected officials who may want to run for mayor. It's a big jump off the cliff if you give up your job. And we're mm-hmm. looking at all of our options now, and we'll see what happens in the next few months.
30 seconds before we have to say goodbye, but do you think this marijuana bill is an issue that, if someone were to run for mayor in Philadelphia, an issue that would garner votes, support?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's wrong to lock up young people for some small misdeed when, in the end, they're not going to be prosecuted by the DA at all. And I think it's a traumatic experience, and all the reasons that we've talked about earlier as to why it shouldn't happen. But I don't usually go after things or take on issues because they're popular. I try to do it because they're right.
Well, on that note, Jim Kenney, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Mark. Have a good weekend.
You too. And he's Democratic Councilman at Large for Philadelphia City Council, serving his sixth term. We have Bob Young waiting in the wings. He covers marijuana as a reporter for the Seattle Times. Again, we're taking your calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY is provided by Interact Theater Company and Gideon's Knot. This drama unfolds during a parent-teacher conference following a young boy's suspension. As reasons for the boy's suspension become more alarming, the issues of violence, creativity, and nature versus nurture are explored. Gideon's Knot runs now through February 9th. Performances take place on the main stage of the Adrian at 2030 Sansom Street in Philadelphia. For tickets, 215-568-8079 or online at interacttheater.org.
Tuesday night, an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Robert Siegel. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech, an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
Tuesday night at 9 on WHYY-TV, online at WHYY.org, and right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Next time on Here and Now...
Hello, Raleigh!
President Obama won North Carolina in 2008, but Mitt Romney took it in 2012. We'll visit the battleground state. Is it red, blue, or purple? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. On January 1st, Colorado opened stores selling marijuana for recreational use, and Washington State is now in the process of licensing pot sellers and distributors. And joining us now is Bob Young. He's a reporter for the Seattle Times who covers marijuana. And Bob Young, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Help us understand Washington Initiative 502. This is the initiative that legalized marijuana in your state for recreational use.
Yes. It's modeled in many ways after the alcohol model in our state, the idea being that adults could responsibly use this intoxicant, marijuana. So we've just been going through a long rulemaking process, and the state was inundated with more than 7,000 applications for business licenses.
Wow.
So they're going through the process of sifting through all those right now.
And this was an initiative that was passed in 2012. So this has obviously taken a couple of years to become the law?
Well, yeah, it was passed in the election November 12, 2012, just as Colorado passed their law. It actually took effect 1 month later, but the initiative is very prescriptive, and it called for state officials to set up this sophisticated regulatory system. And so that's what they've spent a lot of time slogging through. Colorado is much different. They had a very highly regulated medical marijuana industry. And what their law did was allow the people who are already licensed in the medical industry to move into, to have first shot at the recreational industry. So when the stores opened there on January 1st, these were actually folks who were already in the medical business just moving over. We're going a different path, and our stores are not expected to open until sometime between May and July is the best guess.
You said something like 7,000 applications. That seems like a lot of applications.
I believe it is more than they were expecting. And our system is much more decentralized, I guess I would say, than Colorado. Colorado allows vertical integration. You can grow pot and sell it. Ours separates things into different categories. And also, the controversial aspect of this is the state, following the alcohol model, we used to have state-run liquor stores, they're creating or licensing just 334 retail shops in the entire state. They have more than 2,200 applications. So if there are more qualified applicants than stores, they're going to go to a lottery system, which has, you know, a lot of the entrepreneurs on edge because some of them are paying leases now, etc., and they may not end up in the game.
So once those stores open in Washington State, how much marijuana can a person purchase?
Yeah, adults can, the stores are for adults only, and they can purchase 1 ounce of marijuana per visit. It's a little different than Colorado's in that Colorado allows residents to purchase 1 ounce, and it limits non-residents to 1/4 ounce. We don't have that distinction. Everybody, all adults can buy 1 ounce. It's a fascinating little thing. In Colorado, they're wary of this phenomenon known as smurfing, in which people would go and buy lots of smaller amounts, aggregate them, and then take them out of the state and sell them.
Wow.
Colorado is, being more centrally located than Washington, is also surrounded by states with more conservative laws. So they're quite concerned about people, and this is the federal government's, one of the federal government's chief concerns as it allows our experiments to go forward, is they're concerned about diversion or leakage of this legal pot into other states. We do not, our state officials did not have such a concern because there's ample marijuana in British Columbia, in Oregon, in California, so it just didn't seem like that was such a problem. So tourists will be able to come here and buy an ounce of pot at a store.
How about smoking pot? Can people smoke publicly? Are there, you know, coffee houses like there are in Amsterdam, or is this something you have to do in the privacy of your own home or apartment?
Marty, you have to. The law calls requires that that there is no or prohibits public consumption. So yes, people are supposed to do it in the privacy of their homes. There are no cannabis cafes. There's a lot of talk about how to possibly get there. So, for instance, there's a theory that if you had cafes where you did not combust marijuana because of our indoor state smoking ban where you vaporized it, that might be allowed. The law is in the prohibition on public consumption is silent on vaporization, so the chief author of the law has said that could be one way to allow it. But so far, there are no cannabis cafes. It's fascinating because we are in a limbo state where since December of 2012, it's been legal for adults to possess marijuana, but they can't buy it legally anywhere.
Well, interesting. And let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Bob Young. He's a reporter for the Seattle Times that covers marijuana, Washington State, and Colorado, the two states that have legalized marijuana, small amounts of marijuana, for recreational use. We are spending this hour looking at marijuana from a number of different perspectives. Looking for your phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Coaim. Bob, I'm looking actually at an article about Attorney General Eric Holder talking about the fact that Washington and Colorado have legalized marijuana, but wanting to make sure that there can be a lawful place for marijuana businesses to put their profits, to put their money, and having access to the American banking system. Has the federal government sort of loosened its view of legalizing marijuana from your perspective?
I think that's a fair word. You know, the watershed moment came in for the Colorado and Washington experiments came in August when the Department of Justice issued a memo that basically said you can go ahead. It reminded very much reminded people that marijuana remains illegal federally, but they said you can go ahead if you adhere to these eight policy priorities, and they were things like, you know, make sure you keep it away from minors and make sure it is not diverted into other states. So this represents kind of the next important step in federal policy, because the marijuana entrepreneurs tend to deal in cash only because the banks have refused their business if they know it's a marijuana business because it remains federally illegal. So there's great concerns about crime when you're dealing with a cash-only business.
Sure.
And Eric Holder apparently said yesterday in Virginia that they're very aware of this problem and are trying to solve it. The Department of Justice and Treasury are working together, and it appears where we're headed is another memo, like the August one, that says, that gives the banking industry some guidance on what they can do. You know, the question is, will it be enough for the banks, the banking industry? The banking industry wants in, but they want assurances that they're not going to be prosecuted at some point for money laundering or some other crime.
Which, of course, just underscores the complexity of marijuana laws. This is a quote from Eric Holder from yesterday. He said, huge amounts of cash, substantial amounts of cash just lying around with no place for it to be appropriately deposited is something that would worry me just from a law enforcement perspective. Just underscoring what you were just saying there, Bob.
Indeed. And you know, there are stories here of entrepreneurs in the medical marijuana business who've taken tens of thousands of dollars at a time to the Department of Revenue to pay their taxes, dollars that, by the way, smell very much like marijuana. And big smelly piles. And you know, this one entrepreneur goes at $40,000 at a time, big piles of money.
And he was quoted as, you know, when he drives on his way to the Department of Revenue, he it's like out of a heist movie or something. He uses different cars, he takes different routes, he's always mindful that somebody could, you know, rip them off because they know the nature of the business.
Wow. And how about for the state? How much revenue is the state hoping to make off of recreational marijuana?
Boy, this is a kind of a vexing question. There was at one time before the initiative was passed, the state is required to do a financial impact estimate. And so they estimated that it could at some point be bringing $500 million a year to the state in tax revenues. That won't be happening at the outset. That estimate is based on the legal market capturing all the business. And at the outset, our state officials are estimating in year one that they will get just 13 to 25% of the entire market, that the rest will remain in the illicit market or in the medical industry.
And does anyone know how big the illicit or the black market is in marijuana, even in a state like Washington that has legalized recreational marijuana?
Right. Nobody knows. The RAND Corporation tried to do kind of a sophisticated estimate, but in the end, you know, it relied on survey data that, you know, we just can't be sure of its certainty because, you know, people, the belief is that people have not been willing to self-report their drug use. But in any case, it's an astonishing amount. I wrote about it. It's something like 80 million joints a year, I want to say. Of course, people, you know, especially young people, are not smoking joints, but that's just one way. It would be the equivalent of something like 80 million joints a year. And I remember I wrote that it was the estimate came down to pot users consuming about 123 joints a year.
Oh, just doing the
math. Not every Washingtonian, but those who do consuming in that neighborhood a year. A joint every third day, I think it was.
Okay, I was just doing the math in my head. That's Bob Young, reporter for the Seattle Times. He covers marijuana, the second of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Let me get some callers in, Bob, at 1-888-477-9499. We have Ian from Bristol joining us on Radio Times. Ian, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
My question is, why is it that the largest bank in the world was just caught laundering billions and billions of dollars for drug cartels, but they won't accept thousands of dollars from legal marijuana businesses in their own country? It doesn't make any sense.
Does it make sense to you, Bob Young? I heard a chuckle coming from you.
That's a good question, Ian. I think you're referring to HSBC, and indeed, they were complicit in laundering cartel drug money and paid an enormous fine for it. Your question is a good one, but the banks, because of a web of regulations, especially money laundering regulations, they are frankly afraid to touch marijuana money until they have more assurance from the feds that they won't get clobbered for it. But you do point to a glaring inconsistency, I guess you could call it, in the banking industry.
Ian, thanks for the call. Let me get Frank from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us. Hi, Frank. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
My question, or the thrust of the comment, whichever, is about education. In other words, Jim Kenney was talking about education, and I think that's a good way to go. And it would be interesting to see if we could have some comparative studies of the effect of marijuana or pot versus alcohol. I think we already know that alcohol disturbs sleep habits, you know. And so if we had more information about that, it could help regulate people's habits about pot and alcohol, and I think that would be really informative, because now we're on the forefront of dealing with brain problems, brain chemistry, Alzheimer's, the way food affects us.
Sure.
So
well,
this would be...
Let me take your point, Frankus. It's a good one, and it's actually something that the president said, which is to look at both Colorado and Washington State, and let's see how things transpire. Is there active research, Bob, going on in your state about this new marijuana law?
There is some, at the University of Washington. More importantly, perhaps, is the initiative itself earmarks money for the study of the law's impacts. So that will the first impact studies are supposed to occur in July 2015, and that is going to be a really interesting time to see what we learn from this. The caller gets at one of the big questions here, and that is, what will legal marijuana reduce alcohol use?
Right.
There's some reason to believe that could happen, and that's going to be one of the fascinating outcomes to study here.
I would assume also looking at whether this law protects minors from smoking marijuana or not.
Absolutely. That's going to be certainly a big part of the impacts. And so, I'm very eager, and that's the thing I am kind of most interested in. We're adding this new intoxicant to our, to menu of what is legal for adults. And, experts predict that it could add billions of hours of intoxication to American life. And it's going to be curious to see what the impacts of that are.
Well, we have to say goodbye in about a minute and a half, but I'm curious about, are there jurisdictions in Washington State that are saying, we don't want to have retailers within our jurisdiction, we don't want to have a dispensary? Is there any local control on this issue?
Oh, yeah, this is a big issue, Marty, that has just got even hotter. Another difference between the two states, Colorado allowed cities and counties to opt out, didn't even have to participate. It's my understanding that in part that was done to make the election campaign more palatable to certain jurisdictions. We did not have such a thing, but our state attorney general, in interpreting the law, said that it did not require cities and counties to participate. So now we are going to be wrestling with this question of all of these local jurisdictions who may not want to participate and what to do with the stores that were allocated in those jurisdictions. It could well lead to lawsuits all over from licensed entrepreneurs who can't get into the communities they want. Or the opposite, it could lead to communities ultimately trying to take this to federal court, relying on the federal prohibition to maintain their own moratoriums, if you will, on pot businesses.
Well, Rob Young,
but
thank
the city of Seattle, I would just add, is very welcoming, and we have our city attorney is trying to argue with the state to allow us to have more retail pot shops than those that have been already allocated.
Well, my thanks to you, Bob Young, for joining us in this hour of Radio Times, reporter for the Seattle Times, who covers marijuana. Thanks so much, Bob.
Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And stay with us. We'll be right back. We have a third guest waiting to talk. We'll be right back.
Open Connections, a progressive educational environment, supports WHYY. At Open Connections, youth ages 2 through 18 attend programs 1 to 3 days a week from September to June. Guided by their principles of respect, freedom, responsibility, and natural learning, Open Connections serves as a community base for young people and their families seeking an innovative, collaborative, and process-conscious educational environment. An open house at their campus in Newtown Square is Sunday, February 9th at 4 p.m. Details at openconnections.org.
Four pirates!
The film Captain Phillips, about a hostage drama at sea, is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture and is now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the film's star, Tom Hanks, and its director, Paul Greengrass. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm.
The friends of Hillary would more than fill a Lincoln bedroom.
The Clintons have been collecting friends, advisors, people who feel invested in her future for 40 years. But it also creates a lot of not knowing where you stand.
Do longtime Clinton loyalists gum up what looks like a well-oiled 2016 campaign machine? What to do about the FOH factor next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, getting a roundup on some marijuana news. Finally, we want to talk about some of the health effects of smoking pot on the adolescent brain, and we asked Stacey Gruber to join us. She's director of the Cognitive and Clinical Neuroimaging Corps at McLean Hospital's Brain Imaging Center, also an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And Stacey Gruber, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks. Nice to be here.
I'm curious about whether you think, with a much more lax attitude towards marijuana that we're seeing, not just from the president, but I think from many people, or the majority of people across this country, do you anticipate more marijuana smoking among adolescents?
So it's a great question. And actually what we've seen in the last few years is perception of risk and harm by adolescents and emerging adults is now at an all-time low. And that's most likely because of these ongoing discussions of legalization and medicinal use. So I think it's not a question of will we. I think as we've already seen that. And people, you know, emerging adults and adolescents are not only smoking a little more often, they're also starting at younger and younger ages. The average age of first use has dropped from a little over 18 years of age to about 17 and a half in a very short period of time. So that's a little bit of a concern given the developing brain.
Sure. Well, and this is what you have been looking at, your research really looking at pot smoking's effect on this developing adolescent brain. Help us understand how you do what you do.
Sure. So we do lots of different types of studies that look at brain structure and function and something called neurocognitive or neuropsychological performance. And really that's just an elaborate sort of title for things like how well are you able to do tasks that require you to inhibit or not respond to something that you really want to respond to. And we basically bring people in who are chronic heavy smokers. It's important to note that the folks that I study are all adults,
right?
But they basically report having used either prior to age 16 or after age 16. So we're looking at, ostensibly, a fully developed brain, but these are individuals who began smoking early or late, relatively speaking. And we do lots of different multimodal neuroimaging techniques, and again, we acquire these lovely brain images. We have these great pencil and paper tasks and clinical scales, and we're able to really have a close look at whether or not marijuana introduced early, you know, during a period of neurodevelopmental, what we call vulnerability, is making any difference. Mm-hmm. That is, relative to those who start later. And from our research, we see that it does. So starting earlier seems to really have an impact in your ability to do certain tasks that prove to be pretty important in everyday life.
And are you talking about, let's say, someone that started smoking marijuana, let's say, before 16? Are we talking about heavy users or occasional users of marijuana?
So it's, again, a really great question. Lots of literature is sort of a little inconsistent. Lots of people look at different types of smokers. For our studies, we choose individuals and we only enroll people who have a minimum of 2,500 times in their lives, which is a fair amount.
Yeah.
They have to smoke a minimum of 4 to 5 days per week, and their urine has to be positive for urinary cannabinoids. So they have to be sort of current smokers, you know, nearly every day. 4 to 5 days a week is pretty much, it's almost every day. So these people have to have been smoking either prior to age 16 and met that criteria or after age 16 and meeting that criteria.
But
so they're all heavy smokers.
But do you think this is an at-risk population for other destructive or potentially dangerous habits?
In terms of the individuals who start prior to age 16?
Yeah. I mean, if you're smoking that much pot and you're that young, I would assume that there might be other things going on in your life.
It's a good question, and it's one of those things that's best addressed with longitudinal studies,
right,
where we look at people who don't smoke marijuana with the assumption that some will begin and some won't, and we try to figure out what the relationships are. In our sample, we don't see any psychopathology that's different in the early versus later onset smokers. So it's another really important aspect of our research. These folks are all psychiatrically healthy. So they don't have major depression. They don't have anxiety. They don't have lots of different types of disorders that we read about in folks who smoke pretty chronically. This is a pretty high-functioning sample, which is even more compelling in my mind with regard to a public health policy. These are people who aren't necessarily going on to develop other things. They happen to smoke a fair amount of marijuana on a regular basis.
And their brains look different from non-marijuana smokers?
They do. As a whole, the marijuana smokers look different from non-smokers with regard to what we call executive function tasks mediated by the frontal part of your brain, the ability to make decisions sort of in the face of stress, the ability to maintain what we call set or focus, the ability to inhibit inappropriate responses, how to not say something you really want to say, which is so hard for adolescents and teenagers anyway. We see that they have specific difficulty on those types of tasks, but really interesting, when you separate the smokers into early versus late, it's the early onset smokers who really drive most of those differences. And it's almost the same story when we look at brain function. We look at brain function, we're looking at activation during tasks while they're inside a scanner, which parts of their brain may be activated versus less activated. And in fact, the smokers look different from the non-smokers, and the early onset smokers look different from the later onset smokers. So, you know, it clearly is taking a toll. And I think some of the more recent work that we've done looking at white matter differences really underscores the point that early exposure to marijuana leads to structural brain differences, which is something that we really need to be paying attention to.
And obviously the younger a person is, the younger their brain is, the more it's, what, malleable, it's still evolving, still developing?
Exactly. The brain is literally, quote, under construction, if you will. I like to think of it, you know, in terms of sort of a something in progress. And we have the brain developing from the back to the front and from the bottom to the top. The very last part of the brain to become fully developed is the frontal cortex. Yeah. And that's the part of your brain that's so critical for these frontal executive functions. And what we see, again, are differences in the ability to do these tasks mediated by that part of the brain. And white matter differences. White matter, we think of the brain that, you know, consists of gray matter, white matter, and cerebrospinal fluid. Gray matter are the sort of hard-working cell bodies of your neurons. White matter, though, is critically important for transmission between brain regions. And we look at something called white matter integrity. How well organized is that white matter? And it appears that the earlier you start smoking marijuana, the lower the organizational coherence of the white matter, which, again, when you take all of these things together, is a particularly concerning picture in the adolescent who's still developing.
How about effects on things like memory? Then we'll get to our callers.
So there have been a number of studies that demonstrate impact of marijuana on memory function, working memory in particular, and there are some structural studies that show differences in hippocampal volume. The hippocampus is part of your brain that's involved with memory consolidation and storage. So there have been a number of studies that document changes in, again, in these executive functions. Working memory is part of the executive system as well, and then longer-term memory. So it's an important point, especially in the developing brain, which is so sensitive to drugs and alcohol.
Well, we're talking about the health effects of marijuana on the adolescent brain. And again, our guest is Stacey Gruber, director of the Cognitive and Clinical Neuroimaging Corps at McLean Hospital's Brain Imaging Center. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get Jay from Cherry Hill to join us. And Jay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, ladies. I actually think that one of the reasons that I can function so effectively and so well and smoke cannabis daily is because I didn't start smoking until I was in my early 20s. By then, I think I my brain was pretty much fully formed, and that's why I think I can do that today. And even though I'm a marijuana activist and I want to sort of liberalize the laws surrounding cannabis, if a youngster came to me smoking pot, I'd yank it right out of their hands and smack them back in the head.
And Jay, you use marijuana for a medical condition, yes?
Yeah, exactly. I actually smoke cannabis legally in New Jersey, where we have a medical marijuana program. But frankly, I don't drink, and I like to smoke pot. And if it were legal to smoke recreationally, I'd probably do that too. But again, I'm very, very adamant about youngsters, especially high school and even in college. You know, wait until you're out of college. Wait until you're old enough to drink and start smoking pot then, because then you can sort of function on a normal level and not be that sort of stoner stereotype in your mom's basement.
Jay, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Stacey Gruber, do you agree with his assessment?
You know, I think if we had more people who talked about sort of underscoring that message, what we like to say, quote, it's worth the wait, we'd be in a far better position these days. You know, he raises a very good point. Individuals, you know, kids, emerging adults in middle school, high school, their brains just aren't fully developed. And when you introduce cannabis, marijuana, it's clear from these studies and other studies that there's going to be an impact. And, you know, I'm not at all surprised. There are lots of people who can smoke every day and not necessarily experience any ill effect. That doesn't mean that everyone should, especially individuals who aren't fully developed. Yeah. That's the big message.
And from the changes that you're seeing in brain functioning and even the images of these brains, is that permanent? Are we talking about a permanent change?
So it's a really great question. And one of the things we're looking at or trying to look at in our ongoing studies is what happens when people stop smoking. Because, first of all, it's difficult to make people aware of, you know, what they, quote, could have if, in fact, they're pretty convinced that the damage is already done. So it's really important to know what happens after, you know, you stop. We've done some shorter-term abstinence studies, 30 days, for example, and people begin to look, quote, more like healthy controls who don't smoke. Mm-hmm. Does that mean there's no long-term residual impact? It's too soon to tell. It really is. Unfortunately, the longitudinal data isn't necessarily particularly consistent on this topic, and there's a striking lack of it in the literature.
Is there a time at which our brain really stops developing and starts going backwards, if you know what I mean?
So let me just...
Or feels that way anyway.
It certainly does as we get older, doesn't it?
It does, indeed.
So the frontal cortex, yeah, as I mentioned, is the last part of your brain to become fully developed. And unfortunately, it's the first to go. As we age, you know, we can see this in people, you know, I've heard lots of people compare very young children to very old people in that they don't necessarily have, quote, a filter. They don't know what they should and shouldn't say. They're sort of inappropriate at times. With that said, again, that part of your brain is particularly sensitive to drugs and alcohol. Is there a time when we know you're fully developed? To your caller's point, you know, starting later, that is in your mid-20s or so, is certainly better for your brain, perhaps, than starting prior to age 16. People at the National Institutes of Health who are continuing to do some of the, you know, most important groundbreaking work on brain development, like Jay Geed, suggest that the brain develops throughout the second and perhaps even into the third decade of life. So I wish we had these lovely devices that turkeys come with that pop up and say, yep, we're done, we're ready, go ahead. It's all clear. You can have what you like, but we don't. So we have to be judicious and we have to educate people. We're not suggesting you should never, never, ever do it. That never works particularly well. As a message, but, you know, again, just wait until perhaps you're a little more mature.
But are there other, I mean, are there, we know about the dangerous chemicals in cigarettes beyond, you know, the obvious, and I'm wondering with marijuana, are there dangerous chemicals in a marijuana cigarette that we should be aware of and careful of?
So another really, really great question. You know, it's a lot of people are concerned about the increased level of tar in marijuana versus regular nicotine-based cigarettes, and that's certainly not my area of expertise. Some then counter that and say, but you smoke so much less marijuana than you do nicotine, it's not an issue. In terms of other chemicals and things that marijuana is treated with, it's a fairly pure substance when treated properly. Unfortunately, what we've seen in the last 5 years or so is an increased incidence of things like K2 and spice, these synthetic marijuana compounds, because they're legal. And those compounds are treated with all sorts of rather horrific chemicals, which are incredibly neurotoxic. So, you know, again, people say, well, I'd rather have marijuana than K2, and I'm not sure that I would disagree from the quote, harsh chemical perspective. But, you know, I think there's an awful lot of work to be done. I think marijuana as marijuana is considered an herb, but do we really know the impact of all of the different, you know, constituents? I'm not sure we do.
Let me squeeze up.
Additional marijuana. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. Let me just squeeze one a caller on before we have to say goodbye. This is Justin from Westchester. Justin, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is, the people that were in the studies that you're referencing, were they asked about their alcohol use as children as well? Or because I know you're... you know, you're drawing conclusions about them, you know, smoking early, but does alcohol consumption have anything to do with that? And was that asked of the participants?
Stacey Gruber, go ahead.
So another really, really great question, and thank you for that. We do a full clinical interview, and we ask about lifetime history of alcohol to make sure that they don't meet for abuse or dependence. So everybody in our study has to be free of alcohol dependence lifetime or abuse. What that means is none of these people could have been using alcohol to any degree of even perceived excess. In fact, they have rather low levels of alcohol use, higher levels of alcohol use than the healthy controls, but in the grand scheme of the general population, relatively lower levels. No one met for alcohol dependence. Some met for past alcohol abuse because, quite frankly, in this country, it's hard to be a college student and not meet for abuse where you've done one thing inappropriately after having had a drink. So, but it's a very good question. We don't see a relationship between early alcohol use and these changes in brain structure and function in our studies, but it's a great question.
Final one. We have a quick email from Paul. The research you do, is it on rats or on human beings?
No, these are humans. These are humans. It's hard to get rats to do all these tasks.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah, we can't make things that small, unfortunately. But no, it's much more for our research. It's much more telling to actually study humans. But there are animal analogs that are ongoing with regard to these types of studies. So another important part of research. But we study humans.
Well, I thank you so much, Stacey Gruber, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Certainly. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And she's director of the Cognitive and Clinical Neuroimaging Core at McLean Hospital's Brain Imaging Center and associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, the third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us, and stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.